Last weekend, the shooting death of 23-year-old Seville Smith by 24-year-old Milwaukee police officer Dominique Hagen led to two nights of violent unrest in the Sherman Park neighborhood. Eight businesses were set on fire. Six squad cars were damaged, four officers were injured, and one teenager was shot in the neck. The teenager would survive his injuries. Crime reporters Ashley Luthern and Gina Barton wrote a story addressing two prominent questions that emerged following the unrest. Why did this happen? And why didn't it happen sooner? The shooting death of Seville by an officer was the spark, but the problem stems from decades of systematic issues, including segregation and poverty. Milwaukee is among the most segregated cities in the United States. As Ashley and Gina stated in their story, two-thirds of Milwaukee County's incarcerated African-American men come from six zip codes in the poorest neighborhoods of Milwaukee. Two of them include Sherman Park. Sherman Park was once home to manufacturing jobs that offered livable wages. When manufacturing left the city, opportunities for the same livelihood diminished. High unemployment, poverty, and a sense of pessimism are now dominant in the neighborhood. In today's Behind the Headlines, we're going to focus on the unrest and how the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covered it. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thank you for joining me. Aaron Mack was a news intern at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this summer. The unrest would occur during the last night of his internship. Aaron was live on the scene when members of the crowd started threatening one of our photo interns. Members of the crowd would eventually turn on Aaron as well. Aaron is back in San Diego now before starting his senior year at Yale. He joined me via Skype to discuss what happened that night. Before I play the interview, there are a few names you should know. Mike Mulvey is one of our news editors. He was the editor that night. Jacob Carpenter is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Calvin Mathias is our photo intern, and again, Ashley Luthern is our crime reporter. Here's Aaron's story. Can you walk me through what happened on Saturday night?
So I was actually sent to go check out a homicide. The editor that day, Mike Mulvey, said that there had been a lot of homicides the night before, and this looked like there's another one adding to that total. And we hadn't know that a policeman was involved when I went out there. When I got there, I noticed there were a ton of people there, and I went over to ask some policemen what was going on, and they said they're going to hold a press conference. And then I got a message from Jacob, who said that, you know, there's a policeman involved in this. This is like a lot different from what we thought it was. And then so after the press conference, they just basically said, you know, this was police involved. They just gave some like brief facts about what happened, you know, that the person was pulled over with someone else, was chased and was shot. So after that, I was going around to talk to neighbors and everything, and came to, I guess, the intersection of, I think it was North Hour and is it West Sherman, somewhere around there, and saw a ton of people and a line of policemen, and there were a lot of people were really mad. They were yelling at the policemen. So Mike told me to stay there and just kind of report on what was going on there. So, yeah, I guess things were escalating a lot. There's a lot of pushing of the line of policemen. People were ripping down the yellow tape. There's sometimes like people would throw rocks. And I think the policemen were just there because they were still trying to handle the crime scene and didn't want anyone going in before they were done, though I'm not totally sure like what they were doing. And as they left, this line of policemen, you know, they all got in their cars and left to go. And people started like running after these cars, and they smashed a squad car that was parked on a sidewalk. I don't think anyone was in there, but that's when things started getting really, really violent. So they smashed that police car, and then they went back and started smashing another car that didn't look like a police car. I don't know if it was unmarked or what, it was just a civilian car. And that eventually caught on fire. So I was trying to like videotape all the destruction. I think Jacob and Calvin showed up at around that time. I saw Jacob taking pictures of the burning car. Calvin started taking pictures of the burning car, and Jacob met up with me there. And I remember at one point, a lot of the police force came back to the area, and we saw a huge group of policemen in riot gear come walking down the street. And that's when we heard around 6 or 7 gunshots. The policemen officers all kind of got down, started hiding behind trees. Calvin, Jacob, and I all ran behind a Chevy Suburban. Sometime after those shots stopped, Calvin got up from behind the car and started taking pictures. I stayed behind, but I heard someone like yell at him to stop taking pictures, and they were insulting him because he was white. And I saw him run away from a group of people down the street. I didn't know what to do, but I thought I should probably help. So I started running in that direction too. I was running towards him. I yelled at him to get out of the area, and he had dropped his cameras at one point to go faster. So I went over to try to pick them up. I'm not sure how long I had them. I think I must have dropped them pretty quickly because they started chasing after me too. I think they associated me with him when I yelled at him. Yeah, so I started running from a group of people too, and they caught up with me in front of a liquor store, and they threw me to the ground. I just rolled up to a ball, and they struck me for a bit. I don't know how long it was. Kind of time kind of went kind of slow at that point. And then someone ran over. I don't know who. I think it was a group of people ran over and said, you know, stop. He's Asian. He's not white. And then I saw Vaughn Mays Bay. He's a local activist. He came over and said, you know, I know this guy. And he had the cameras at that point. I think he had picked them up after I tried to get them. He gave them to me, and he escorted me back to the Boys and Girls Club, Ashley Lutheran, then picked me up from there. The details of everything are a little, because it happened so fast, the details are a little fuzzy to me still, so it might not match up exactly with what other people remember, and that would probably just be because, yeah, it happened really fast and a lot of adrenaline was going on, so.
And are you doing okay right now?
Yeah, I'm doing great. There's no serious injuries, so yeah, just some scratching and bruising and stuff, but nothing terrible.
Now that you've had a few days to reflect on this, has this changed how you see the city or in other ways shaped the summer that you had here?
I have to give a lot of credit to everyone who helped me out of that situation. Vaughn Mays Bay and a lot of other people who came and intervened. It actually gave me a lot of faith in that community, just that they would help. They wouldn't just be a bystander. They would actually come and help someone who was in trouble. So it made me a lot more, I don't know how to say this, but yeah, it made me a lot more optimistic about the community than pessimistic, I suppose. This kind of thing happens to people every day. I think people have to deal with this kind of violence, like getting mugged and jumped. And I think I have the privilege of choosing when I'm in those situations, and a lot of people don't. So I guess I wouldn't want to put too much emphasis on what happened to me specifically, just because it happens to a lot of people who don't have any other choice, really.
Thank you to Aaron for joining me for that. To read Aaron Mack's work from this summer, including his work covering the unrest, visit jsonline.com. The story I previously mentioned from Ashley and Gina is available there as well. Columnist James Causey has lived in the Sherman Park neighborhood for 4 decades. He said it's stressful hearing police sirens in the neighborhood night after night, but moving isn't a reality for the people who live there. Sherman Park is one of the most diverse neighborhoods in Milwaukee. James said there are good blocks and bad blocks, good houses and bad houses. But the people who live there have formed a community. Leaving that community and entering another neighborhood in the segregated city of Milwaukee is a shaky proposition at best. James joined me to talk about what he saw last weekend, what's next for Sherman Park, and how the community reacted to our coverage. As the events were unfolding Saturday night, what was your reaction?
Saturday night, I was running a bunch of errands earlier Saturday, and when I got home, I turned on the TV to catch some of the Olympics, and I saw the news flash that a man was killed by police in Sherman Park, and I knew exactly where it was, on 44th Street, and I knew all the situation that took place really close to there at that BP gas station, because they had just been protesting there. It was an incident there where one of the owners had fired a shot over some kids' heads, and it sort of had residents really irritated, and they wanted that station shut down. And then it was earlier, it was some confrontations between police and young people in Sherman Park itself, in a park area. So I just knew after I heard that this could probably be bad. But I didn't think much more of it until I started hearing all the sirens. And as the night wore on, I need to go see what's going on. And I was able to see some of it with my own eyes. And when you see that stuff happen, you think about your own safety a little bit. I wasn't really worried about anybody doing anything to me. But I was mostly worried about young people, getting hurt, getting shot. And there was a lot of people upset. And I was like, whoa. And then the confrontation with police. So I didn't stay long. I remember noticing how there were older people who didn't understand what was going on. Like, why are they doing this? And then younger people who seemed to, this is just the beginning. So it was that conflict, and you could see it from in the eyes and hear it in the voices of what people were saying. So I went home, and the very next day, I listened to the news all night, and then the very next day I went out there first thing. So
in your column, you write about the history of manufacturing leaving Sherman Park, about how that created higher rates of unemployment in the neighborhood, about how that set kind of the foundation for some of the things that you're seeing today. And I think coming from you, it's such a voice of authority living in that neighborhood. And one of the critiques of our coverage overall is that we don't have people who live in a diverse area and who live in different neighborhoods in Milwaukee. That overall, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel employs predominantly people who are white. How do you feel when people critique the Journal Sentinel for having a predominantly white staff?
We didn't get this way overnight. I think, as a newspaper and as a news brand, and now we're global, we probably have to do more global recruiting. I remember I got interested in journalism because a columnist by the name of Greg Stanford came to my junior high school and mentioned that he worked at the newspaper. And he told me his story, and I was like, oh, wow, that sounds interesting. And that's how I got interested in journalism. We got to start maybe doing things like that, trying to attract them, young people at a much younger age, and telling them about the possibilities of even working at a newspaper or working for a media group. I don't think a lot of young people in Milwaukee or elsewhere see that as even a possibility. And another thing, if we don't start doing that, I mean, it's only going to get worse, and our criticism is going to be worse. And when we have situations like this that arise, we shouldn't have to struggle to try to find people that could tell those stories. I mean, that's just my opinion. I think just like diverse neighborhood is good for all, and it means the same thing in a workplace.
So this is a broad question, but what's next for Sherman Park?
What's next, or what should be next?
Both.
What's next is I think we have to wait and see. We need this videotape to be released. That needs to happen sooner than later. We need to rebuild. The businesses that were destroyed need to be rebuilt, because that shows a sign of some progress. And we need young, old, and to come together and meet at the table to discuss what happened. Because if you don't discuss what happened and talk about it in detail, it will happen again. So both of those sides need to come together. What needs to happen, or what must happen, is our leaders today must come up with a way to fill that vacancy at Century City. That should be priority number one. When it was A.O. Smith, and A.O. Smith employed thousands of people, making with livable wage jobs. Pretty much since the late 80s, it hasn't been much of anything. And they decided to revamp it, rename it, rebrand it, build up a new building, clean up the area, call it Century City. But right now, I consider it like a hood ornament. If it doesn't, it's shiny, it looks great on a car, but it doesn't serve any purpose unless it's being utilized. And right now it's not. It's still empty. So, you know, what happened over the weekend or last weekend was devastating. It's going to hurt trying to fill that, get a tenant to come in, a major tenant to come in, and they say, you know, violence and things like that. But even before that happened, they had a hard time filling this area. So that shouldn't be looked up as an excuse. And the leadership here can't let that be an excuse. They can't say, well, crime scares people from coming in. Well, you know, once you get someone in and you can show progress, other people will come in too if it's successful. So you have to give them an opportunity to come in and give them the resources they need to be successful here.
James wrote a column after last week's unrest. In this column, James endeavored to explain the events that led to the unrest, including the history of employment or lack thereof in the neighborhood. To find that column, as well as James' other work, visit jsonline.com. We'll hear more about potential business developments in the Sherman Park neighborhood later in today's show. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel named the police officer who was involved in the shooting death of Seville Smith. Officer Dominique Hagen worked as a police aide starting in 2010 before being sworn in 3 years later. There were mixed reactions to our paper naming Dominique. Some people felt that naming him could potentially subject him to harm. Others felt that we were justified in naming him, as the victim's name was already part of the public dialogue. Editor-in-Chief George Stanley talked to me about the decision to name Dominique and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's overall policy about naming officers who are involved in shootings.
The decision was made for our paper to name the police officer who was involved in the shooting on Saturday that led to the unrest. Why did we name the officer?
Well, the names of police officers are always public records, and the names of police officers involved in shootings or use of force always become part of the public record. The only reason this officer's name hadn't already been reported is because the department has its own practices. They're not even a formally written policy that when an officer is under investigation, they do not release his name while that investigation is pending. The state law now requires, it's a new law, just in 2014, that an outside agency performs investigations whenever an officer is involved in a shooting. In this case, it's the State Department of Justice. So while that is pending and while they're looking at the body camera and reviewing the shooting, the Milwaukee Police Department has decided not to release the officer's name. Now, it's everywhere on the internet. All you have to do is search Milwaukee police shooting, and you'll find the officer's name with any Google search, and have been able to do that for days. Over 3,000 people as of yesterday had already shared photos of the officer on Facebook, along with threats or people calming down the threats, saying, please don't do anything, because he was just doing his job. So it was the officer's name is widely known, widely available, very easily available already. It's a public record, and we've always reported officers' names, and it's not up to the police department or anyone else to decide when to release those names.
Can you go into that a little bit more? I know that when the shooting happened with Dontre Hamilton, we also reported the officers' names. Why is that the practice that we have in our newsroom?
I think that's a general practice of newspapers to report public record information when we get it most of the time, unless there's a really good reason not to. Because just like officers wear their names when they're making arrests, there's a reason for that, and they have a badge number. And it's so that people can know who they're dealing with. They're a public employee with a great deal of authority, including use of force. Use of force is the greatest authority we give in our democracy to the government, and people need to be able to know that it's being used according to the law. So in this case, the officer's name was widely known. It was a police practice, not a law, that kept his name out of the public. We thought it was really important to report about the threats he was receiving. We had a long conversation about this with everyone involved in this story. Nobody thought that we could possibly be endangering the officer's life since the people making the threats already knew who he was. And we didn't get the sense that the police felt that way either. They didn't ask us to keep it private or anything. That's just their practice. I don't think anyone thought that reporting his name contributed in any way to problems regarding the officer.
And you wrote that the Milwaukee Police Department knew that we were going to run his name in the paper. Mm-hmm. How did that conversation come about? Is it usual to give them the heads up that these things are coming?
When we're dealing with anybody, really, we let them know so they can respond to us when we're writing about them. And we talk to the people. We're very honest and open and transparent. And usually when someone is concerned about, oh, please don't release that, say not an officer, it's a witness. And they say, please don't release that. We're worried about that witness. They'll talk to us, and we will agree not to release names if we think someone could be endangered. In this case, we did not think that was the case. Nobody told us that was the case. And we felt it was important that the city know the threats the officer was facing, and that they know whether the government was responding to those threats. That's another thing that, how can we function as a society if we don't address these types of threats? That officer should have every right to come back and do his job if he's cleared of any wrongdoing and followed policy and everything like that, without any worries of threats against him by a community. So are the police and are the district attorneys going to do something about this? That's part of the story, too.
George Stanley also wrote a column about the decision to name the officer. You can find that online at jsonline.com. George also said that people who have additional questions about the decision can contact him at gstanley@journalsentinel.com. For that, Stanley is spelled S-T-A-N-L-E-Y. As mentioned earlier in the show, the lack of well-paying employment opportunities in Sherman Park is one of the reasons for dissatisfaction and anger in the neighborhood. There are some plans for development in the area, including housing developments. Those businesses are committed to their plans and will remain in the area. However, businesses who aren't already dedicated to Sherman Park, including businesses with out-of-state developers, may be hesitant to open up shop in the area. Commercial real estate reporter Tom Dakin looked at developments in the area following the unrest. He joined me with the latest. In the article you wrote after the unrest, you talked about how businesses who already had plans to develop in the Sherman Park area are sticking with those plans.
Right.
What are some of those businesses and why are they sticking to their plans?
Well, probably the best known would be Save-A-Lot, which is a deep discount, limited assortment supermarket chain. They have some stores already in Milwaukee, but nothing in this part of Milwaukee that close to the central city, certainly not that close to where the riot occurred basically over the weekend. And Save-A-Lot had disclosed plans in June to convert a former Lena's supermarket on just off Fond du Lac Avenue near North Avenue into one of their stores. And, yeah, they're still planning to go ahead and do that. It's a $1.6 million investment. They are getting a couple grants, $100,000 from the city and another $100,000 grant from the neighborhood business owners to help them do some facade work. But, yeah, they're still planning to stay there. And the reason they're planning to do it is because people still have a demand for food items, right? I mean, just, you know, not to sound flip, just because you have a night or two of criminal disturbances and civil unrest doesn't mean that people in the neighborhoods don't still want a grocery store. I mean, you know, so there is that. The other developments that are ongoing and are still proceeding are primarily residential developments. They're just this week there was an apartment development plan for North Avenue and 15th Street, which would be about a mile and a half from 35th Burline Fondy, which is where a lot of those businesses were looted or burned. And that's proceeding. The developer of that project said something interesting. David Block, who's with Evergreen Real Estate out of Chicago, David Block said, he would have been really surprised if the kind of violence you saw at 35th and Burleigh had occurred in the 15th and North neighborhood. And the reason he said that is because Walnut Way Conservation Corp. has had such a long track record of working in that portion of the inner city, doing some really positive things, community gardens, converting a vacant lot to a public park. Walnut Way actually last fall got into commercial development and opened a small mixed-use development with a little outpost, natural food store, and some other businesses. And David Block's point of view is that Walnut Way's good work over the past 10, 12, 15 years kind of has helped create a real sense of belonging among the residents there that would tend to work against the kind of activity, the kind of behavior we saw, unfortunately, at 35th and Burleigh. And while you have other good community groups operating in all sorts of neighborhoods throughout the central city, unfortunately, you may not have as strong an effort as what Walnut Way has done up in that area at 35th Burleigh and Fondy, where some of the bad stuff happened.
Do you think these continued developments could potentially have the same effect as the Walnut Way developments had in a different neighborhood?
They certainly would help. I mean, I think in particular of those duplexes and those houses being converted to rental properties. Now, that's happening in an area I'm trying to describe roughly bordered by well east of 35th Street, but let's say from 35th several blocks east between south of Burleigh up to, I don't know, approximately maybe Concordia Avenue. That's an area with a lot of despair and a lot of poverty. Those are the 20th streets and the 30th streets where we have, you know, a lot of poverty, a lot of crime. And the fact that you're creating decent, affordable housing in that area for families can have a huge positive impact on that neighborhood. You get people living there who are they have jobs. They want to see their children succeed in school. They share all the common goals that most of us have as, frankly, just as human beings, period. That can have immensely positive effect. And not coincidentally, that area is relatively close to a development I haven't talked about, but Century City, which is the effort to create a large business park at what used to be the A.O. Smith / Tower Automotive factory, which is south of Capitol Drive between roughly 30th and 35th Streets. And that's moving forward. There is a brand new industrial building there that has yet to land a tenant, but there have been tenants interested in. Hopefully some of them didn't get scared off, you know, by the crap that happened over the weekend, but there are efforts to redevelop that area on the commercial and the industrial side as well.
One unfortunate effect of the unrest is that businesses that didn't already have plans to develop in Sherman Park may be hesitant to develop there. What does that mean for the people who live there?
Well, unfortunately, it means that they and the people I advocate for them are just going to have to work harder. I think that's going to have the biggest effect on potential investors and developers that are from Milwaukee. If you're from Milwaukee, if you're in the development realm in Milwaukee, you know that the North Side is not just one big amalgamation of crime and poverty, even though it's portrayed that way by some of the less responsible members of this community. And frankly, by some of the more racist members of this community. There actually are neighborhoods throughout the North Side that are doing pretty well. There are others that aren't doing so well. Some are doing horribly, frankly. But it's not all one big zone of crime and poverty, the way it's been portrayed. The people are smart and are aware. They know that. Now, unfortunately, if you have someone from Chicago, New York, you name the city, if they see, you know, a national news report on TV, or if they read something in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, if they don't know the community, they may not make that distinction quite as easily. They may just look at it and say, Milwaukee, North Side, forget it. I don't even want to think about it. I've got other places where I can spend my time and energy to try and make money as a developer, as a business operator. So it's up to people who are in charge of recruiting and trying to bring investment in those neighborhoods to make that case aggressively, to say, no, look, we're more than that. We have assets here. Here's the best case we can make. But let's not sugarcoat it. It hurts. It hurts. I mean, you have a night like you had Saturday night, Sunday night not so great either, but particularly Saturday night, where you have a bank, an auto parts store, a beauty supply store getting looted, torched, a gas station getting torched. That sends a horrible message. And yeah, you have to work to counterman that, basically.
As with the rest of our coverage, Tom's story is available at jsonline.com. We've also created a separate landing page with all of our coverage of the unrest. That can be found at projects.jsonline.com/topics/Sherman-Park. Again, that's projects.jsonline.com/topics/Sherman-Park. That's all for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Join me next week as I take you behind the scenes at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.